1915.
So we know where we were in 1914. On the Western Front, basically, fluid war ended, static. The Eastern Front, Germany's being successful, Austria is kind of failing miserably, and now you got the Ottomans in. Well, a new year brings reflection on the events that occurred in the previous year. And the same was true in all of the capitals of the combatant nations. Starting with the... Starting with the Germans. There was a huge argument that erupted in the general staff. Fortunately, they recognized that the Schlieffen Plan, which was the be-all and end-all, obviously failed because you get to December 31st, 1914, and that's a lot longer than the envisioned 6 weeks. They were never able to knock France out of the war. They were never able to reposition all their strength into the east and beat the Russians down. Instead, they're bogged down in the west with most of their forces, but in the east, where they have the least, they're actually making headway, which tactically makes no sense whatsoever. So how are you going to win the war? Well, Falkenhayn, who takes over from Moltke, who is forced to resign after the failure of the Schlieffen Plan, believes adamantly that in order to win the war, Germany must win in the West. But other than this belief, he actually had no evidence, no statistics, no data, no proof that Germany could actually break the stalemate. It was just his belief. Eastern Front, Ludendorff and Hindenburg could actually boast of impressive successes with meager military forces. Remember, they defeated two entire Russian armies completely. One of the generals committed suicide. When Ludendorff started hearing that Falkenhayn was building another potential reserve army, Ludendorff said, give them to us. We'll win in the east. We can knock Russia out, and then we can take the eastern forces and switch to the west. And Ludendorff, in his report to the Kaiser, was bold, claiming that Russia could be defeated within 6 months. If only you gave us the military edge. Well, the Kaiser sits back and asked Falkenhayn if Ludendorff was right. Falkenhayn, of course, had to admit, okay, if we take most of our new army and we shift it to the east, we can prop up the Austrians, and instead of having a single small front advancing, we might be able to advance all throughout Galicia. But ridiculed the idea that Russia could completely be knocked out in 6 months with just a few more reserve troops. So at the end of the day, Ludendorff goes to Berlin, Hindenburg is in the front, but Falkenhayn is there as chief of staff. The Kaiser listens to them both and then decides to fudge it. After a meeting with the war cabinet, the Kaiser decided to split the difference. And by the way, under the German system, the Kaiser was the commander-in-chief, and he technically was the head of the German army. So he decided that the Eastern Front was the priority, but not to the extent that Germany could not launch an offensive in the West. So in other words, we're going to raise enough through the draft to raise four new armies. We'll split the difference. Two goes west, two goes east. So as a result, Hindenburg and Ludendorff knew they didn't have enough to knock Russia out. So what does that mean? Are they going to continue to just randomly throw strikes at the Russians and hope something gives? And then Falkenhayn in the west, two armies, extra armies, is not enough to break through the ever-increasing size of the Allies. While the French maxed out, England continues to pull more and more men in for the expeditionary force. So, long story short, the decision was made to not give either side enough to actually potentially win. So what does that mean? 1915 is going to go into 1916 with no end in sight. As far as Austria, January 1st, 1915 was no new year for them. No. Austria was still reeling from the disasters of the battle for Galicia. As we know, they had retreated. They had pulled back after they attempted to penetrate Galicia. They retreated to Caspian Mountains. Carpathian Mountains. And of course, as I mentioned, if they failed in holding the line, the Russians would have an easy ride into the Hungarian plain, which means on to Budapest and then Vienna. They could be knocked out like that. So, Conrad decides to rest his hopes on a single military position, which again, to go back to this map, located right there. The fortress city of Przemyśl. Przemyśl was like Liege. It was a city that was encircled by a fortress. Technically, Przemyśl was the third largest fortress in all of Europe. It had the city interior supported by a fortified military position that was encircled by military towers, manned with guns and artillery. 28-mile ring, 44 towers, 50 miles of interconnecting trenches, 650-plus miles of barbed wire, all mixed in. Now, the fort itself was designed to hold a maximum of 88,000 troops. But with the retreat, Conrad almost doubled the number, increasing it to 130,000. Plus, there were 18,000 civilians there. So what does this mean? Food. Beds. Warm clothes. Places to go poo-poos and pee-pees. Medical stuffs. What was there, it was insufficient to support what had happened. Now, the Russians would attempt to strike Przemyśl early as September 1914. As they were sweeping in and splitting the lines, zeroed in on the fort, hoping that if they could conquer it, that really was the only thing standing in their way in terms of a fortified military position. General Radko Dmitriev, not that you need to remember his name, it's not going to come up, I don't think, was in command of the 3rd Russian Army. He believed that he could engage the fort similar how the Germans did to Liege. So, he orders an artillery bombardment relatively short, but they didn't have any big field mortars like the Germans did that could basically turn the towers into dust. And then believed he could win by overwhelming the defenses with human beings. He actually ordered a charge, which was absolutely disastrous because some of the forts were located uphill. Small hill. But like Breed's Hill, when the British in their redcoats tried marching up, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. The Austrians simply put their guns down, including their artillery, in open fire. It was disastrous. In 3 days, the Russians suffered 40,000 casualties. But the Austrians were trapped because Conrad ordered them not to surrender. So they were sitting ducks when the Russians began to reposition their soldiers. And in November, the second siege began. Joining the Third Army was the newly created 11th Army under Andrei Slavonov. He brought in 170,000 soldiers, boosting Dmitriev's 130,000. So he would launch a siege of the city. We're talking an old school siege that would last for 130 days with 300,000 soldiers. How did they do it? Instead of marching right for the fort, they simply went around and encircled the position. And they intentionally stayed just out of the ranges of the guns. They didn't have accurate intelligence, but they knew that there was more people in the fort than probably should be. So, like the way they used to do it during the Middle Ages, you surround the shores, fort, and you starve them out. Because what are they going to run out of?
Food.
And then what happens when they run out of food?
They die.
Why?
They can't eat.
They can't eat. Human body begins to deteriorate. Your immune system breaks down. You're more susceptible to disease. And if you have a whole bunch of people trapped in an area with no clear sanitary places to do your bodily goods, then there's likelihood of going to be an outbreak of some type of disease. It's going to kill you. And then you're going to be forced to surrender. Now, here is the problem. As we said, Conrad was not a battlefield experienced commander. He was a theorist, which kind of makes him kind of like a politician. And in his communications, his focus was not on the lives of his soldiers. His focus was not on maintaining the position, but rather he was focused on the political consequences. What would happen to me? How would I look? Could I lose my job? So instead of coming up with some type of strategy on how to prevent the fort from falling, he simply told them, hold the fort at all costs. If you run out of food, eat grass, eat bark, eat rats. If you run out of medical supplies, rip up uniforms for bandages. And if you run out of ammo, that's why all standard issue rifles came with a bayonet. Now, the only thing that kind of saved Conrad's behind for 130 days was the fact that as bad as the Austrians were, the Russians weren't doing so swell either. By January, nearly one-third of all of the Russian soldiers deployed, because they kept making new armies and sending them out, one-third actually lacked rifles. You had some troops involved in sieges and battles.
That literally walked into battle holding clubs and spears and pitchforks.
The soldiers were ordered, "Oh, if you don't have a rifle, don't worry about it. Your comrade to your left and your right will be dead soon. When they die, pick it up and charge into battle with that." To make matters worse, the new armies that were being created received less training than the Austrian soldiers did. Draftees literally were on the front lines within 4 weeks of reporting. They spent more time getting their uniform fitted than actual receiving combat training. The 11th Army under Selenov, his army literally was created in October, and he was arrived at the front lines on a major siege in November. How do you think those soldiers felt? People who were just a month ago on the farm. And they didn't report until October because they had to participate in the harvest. Good luck with your doctor's appointment. How bad was it? Well, stationed with the Russian 11th was a British observer, Major General Sir Alfred Knox. In his report to the British General Staff, he reported, and I quote, "The Russian troops make a bad impression. Most of them seem listless, of brutally stupid type. They're of poor physique and stamina. Not an inspiriting..." "Not an inspiriting spectacle." In other words, you look at them and you know what you're getting, and it's not good. To make matters worse... To make matters worse, they suffered a serious shell shortage. Out of all of the armies, including the Ottomans, they had the smallest stock of ammunition, rounds, for their artillery. When 1915 rolled around, artillery batteries were limited to firing just 4 rounds per day. So how are you going to break a fortress if you only can fire 4 rounds? Ammunition, also short. When the Russian General Staff realized how few rifles were actually being deployed, that's when they began digging through their old warehouses and purchasing on the world market anything they could get their hands on. There were Mexican-made rifles, there were Japanese rifles that were picked up in the Russo-Japanese War. Heck, they were even told to pick up the guns from the dead Austrians. So because, once again, as we talked about, they had so many different types of rifles, if you picked up, say, a rifle from a dead Austrian, maybe you get 4 rounds left in the magazine. So guess how many shots you got? And then what are you going to do once you make those shots? Throw the rifle down and pick up another one and hope it has ammunition in it. Because a soldier had a better chance of finding a rifle with a few rounds in it than finding a box of ammunition. Now, Britain and France, being Russia's ally, did want to help. But again, in the reports that I've read, they basically said, "We don't have enough for our own men. Sorry, you're kind of on your own." But in spite of it, And this was the weirdest thing. The Russian government was optimistic because, first and foremost, they knew how screwed the Austrians were. They believed, kind of like how the German mindset was, the Russians believed if they could knock the Austrians out, then they could reposition their troops and go all in against Germany and simply overwhelm the Germans. And once they did that, they could take control of the Balkans and possibly look to the Ottomans. But they couldn't go all in against the Austrians because they had to deal with the Germans, who were destroying entire armies with less numbers. Again, literally, you can see the lines. Look, the red arrows end up going back. The Austrians have to withdraw, but look at the red arrows for the Germans. They're going forward. Literally, the front was flipping. The Russians had to deal with that situation. So they couldn't go all in against the Austrians. If they did, it would have been over quick. So, like the Kaiser, the Tsar, who was the commander-in-chief, as he got his reports, he too was forced to fudge the numbers. He couldn't give enough to the north or the south to achieve a victory. There was not enough soldiers to hold the Germans back, nor were there enough soldiers to defeat the Austrians by having to fight too. So whenever a new army was raised, one went to the north and the next one went to the south, and vice versa. And Russia in 1915 now had to deal with the fact that the Ottomans were involved, creating a possible southeastern front. But the Central Powers also had to deal with the Russians, because again, we know Russia had the largest military force out of all of them. So, Berlin, Vienna, in Constantinople began communicating on how to deal with this 2,000-mile front. How do you deal with the fact that the Russians have not only 10 armies advancing, but they also have numerous reserve armies? How do you deal with this? Is there a way to kind of make a crack that potentially could have everything fall? So, after deliberating, there was a plan. A joint operation. Germany would continue to push out of Prussia. Austria would have to turn their butts around and drive into Galicia. But a combined Austrian and German offensive would be launched heading towards Warsaw. So instead of having this tilting budge, you would simultaneously drive the front forward. So, the blessings of the Kaiser, Ludendorff convinced Falkenhayn to release 3 of the 4 reserve armies to the east, temporarily. This would allow them to inflate their numbers. And then they would begin. On New Year's Eve, on our calendar, 1915. the newly created Ninth Army would be ordered to attack the recently reestablished Russian Second.
The Ninth Army would be made up of some men from the Eighth and some men that were being moved in. They would simultaneously launch with the Austrian Third and would go forward to kind of bring the line, because this was the goal. Why have this weird bulge? Let's see if we can push the lines forward.
But how do you deal with the Russian steamroller? Well, on January 31st, 1915, the Germans pull a rabbit out of their hat. At the Battle of Bolomov,
a village right here west of Warsaw,
the Germans decided they were going to break the Russian lines quickly by using a secret weapon. They brought up to the front 18,000 shells containing bromide. Do you know what that is?
Mustard gas, isn't it?
No.
Chlorine gas?
No. Xylobromide is a type of tear gas. Now, FYI, a little backstory on chemical weapons. It wasn't the Germans who used it first. It was actually the French. The Battle of the Frontiers, when they were trying to drive into Alsace and Lorraine, the Germans ran into tear gas that the French soldiers hurled at them. Very similar to like the tear gas that the police deploy. So, small quantities, little grenades, but irritating as a mother F. Tear gas, heavy gas, gets exploded out of a canister, creates a plume of air that when you breathe it, it kind of burns your lungs, and when it gets in your eyes, you basically become incapacitated.
It sucks ass.
Yes, you can't see, right. You probably sure were exposed to it in basic.
Oh, yeah, I had to do it every year. I had to qual, so I'd have to be in like a gas chamber the entire time, take my mask off, do freaking jumping jacks, push-ups, while I'm breathing in this shit. It sucks.
Yeah.
Please, your sinus infection.
Oh,
you got a sinus infection, you're feeling pretty good afterwards.
Of course, by being exposed to it, you're going to be less terrified of it. Well, the Germans had never been hit by any of this stuff, so they kind of freaked out. So it was not necessarily lethal, but again, it had the desired effect. When the cloud went poof, the Germans had a tendency to retreat, which allowed the French to go forward. Unfortunately, the French would run out of grenades by November. So wherever the French were engaged, they did use them, but they didn't have enough to turn the tide of the war. Now, by the way, under international law, the use of chemical weapons in warfare was declared illegal. But in the eyes of the German command, French did it first. So if the enemy is going to do it, all fair in love and war. So, oh, I thought there was no coming up. So, the Germans would actually experiment with these shells during the Battle of the Frontier. When they fired fragmentation shells, so they would be launched, and when they were in the air, they basically would crack open, and they would release the gas in a plume of smoke over the heads of the soldiers, knowingly violating the Hague Treaty. I actually had it in there of 1890 when it was declared to be illegal. But the problem was that they didn't have the right concentration. So when the shells went overhead and detonated, the soldiers were like, oh, thank God it's not shrapnel or it's not explosive. They smelt something that smelt odd, but wasn't enough to be an effective irritant. So from October until January, the German chemists at places like BASF and Siemens began experimenting on upping the doses. So this was another round of tests to a degree, and what better test subjects than the Russians? So they unleashed the shells, the canisters erupted, the clouds were vast, actual picture from the battle. And by the way, the Germans were prepped with wearing rudimentary coverings. They had a cotton swab that had a filtration. I don't remember what they had in there for filtration. But the Germans reported it didn't work. Because, unfortunately, because of the fact that this was January in Eastern Europe and it's freaking cold, the gas pretty much didn't expand because the gas froze and droplets fell down. And in the few places where there were big clouds, the way the wind blew, it ended up blowing it back on the German position. So, it didn't quite work out the well way they did. So as a result, the Germans called off the attack. Because the Russians kind of figured out something was wrong, and they unleashed their artillery, the few rounds that they had, and were able to be driven back. Gas freezes, attack called off. Okay. I'm like, I thought I had this stuff in there. But because the offensive switched over from the secret weapons to artillery shells, there was still a lot of casualties. The Germans would suffer 20,000 casualties and the Russians would suffer 4,000 casualties. But at the same point that the newly created 9th begins pulling back, that's where Hindenburg goes on the offensive and would launch the second battle of Marusian Lakes up here in modern Lithuania. Now, Falkenhayn opposed the idea. He didn't like the idea of launching a major offensive that's going to advance the lines, because Falkenhayn was afraid of this, stretching the lines of support and materiel, possibly exposing the southern flank to a strong Russian push, and potentially could result in the severing of East Prussia. But for political reasons, Falkenhayn knew, well, we had to show the Ottomans, who just became our ally, that we could actually inflict damage. So for political reasons, he gave in to Hindenburg's plan. The target was the Russian 10th Army, another newly created force that was rushed to the front lines. In an amazing move that you never think would take place in a World War I battle, Germany, the German army, the 8th Army, was moved. They marched 70 miles during a blizzard and launched an attack from the south. Two days later, because of Hindenburg and his encircling and his delayed strikes, gave orders to the German 10th Army to attack from the north. As the Russians turn to fight one army, before they know it, they got another army coming up their backside. To make matters worse, Russia in the north had issues. The Russian command in the north were idiots, and they had no lines of communication whatsoever. The man in charge of the northern forces was General Nikolai Rutsky. Rutsky was another one of these old-timey Russians. Long career, including some successes in the Russo-Japanese War. And many in the German high command regarded him as the best Russian general in the entire army. But he had a huge flaw. Ego. Ego. He felt his subordinates were all idiots. He believed only he knew what was right. So, when his subordinates tried making suggestions, he insulted them to their faces and wanting nothing to do with it. And here's the classic irony. We'll call it hubris, if you will. On February 6th, the general in charge of the Russian 10th, Thaddeus von Sievers, received word of a possible attack by the Germans that could come as early as the 7th. He sent off several dispatches and asked for reinforcements or even approval to move the army to a more secure location. Rutsky gets this. He thinks von Sievers is an idiot, and he ignores it. Just completely ignores it. Refuses even to allow Sievers to send out recon units. Instead, ordered him to keep all his men in his perimeter. Which is kind of proof positive that no one was paying attention to the lessons of 1914, because if they were paying attention to what happened in 1914, Hindenburg did the same thing at Tannenberg. The exact same thing. The goal was to encircle. You send one flank first, cause the shift, and then you counter with the reverse. So, the pincers easily encircled the Russian 10th. The only thing that prevented a complete destruction was the weather. When Seaver realizes his position, he fires out a quick request to Rutsky to withdraw, informing his commanding officer of the fact that his army is on the verge of being completely destroyed. So Rutsky allows him to retreat. And they use the cover of the snowstorm to basically pull the bulk of the 10th backwards. But, as far as the Russian rear guard, they get decimated. The German managed to capture 92,000 POWs and 300 guns. But the remnants managed to pull back, avoid the ensnarement by the pincer, and retreated to a Russian fort, the fort of Osowick. Osowick is in the current country of Poland. It was, if you remember when I talked about one of the sheer luck things that the Russians did in 1914, where just prior to the start of the war, they spent a whole bunch of money strengthening up some of the forts. This was one of the forts that received the most money. It was one of the best, highly defended forts in all of out of all the Russian forts. So, you got the weather, slow things down. The Russians, some of them managed to limp back to the fort. And when they pursued to the fort, Hindenburg realizes they don't have enough manpower or firepower to actually get into the fort. Because where were all the big field mortars? They were all in the west. So they couldn't do what they did to Liege. Umar, pulverize them. So, just as the Germans seem to think it's going, they have to stall again. At the same time, the Austrians are no help. Conrad completely ignores the request from Falkenhayn to do that joint operation, refuses to try to get around Przemysl, to try to drive into Russia to kind of help buoy up the German advance, because all he's focused on is this city, this fortress. And that's the way it looks. That picture was taken in 2017, if I read the blog correctly. So it's so massive, it's still there. The remnants of it. So, how do you break a siege? Now, just prior to the start of the siege, Conrad was able to get some reinforcements into the city, and he was able to pull out some of the injured from the first siege. But unfortunately, the new men that arrived, they didn't have much in the way of food or medical supplies. So even though he was able to get fresh men in there, it was just a matter of time. And what did the Russians do? Well, they don't attack the fort head on. They bring in their guns, and every single day, for 133 days, they fire everything that they have at the fort. And slowly, the defenses begin to be pummeled. Now, the Austrians did their best. They did their best. There were multiple operations that were launched out of the fort trying to hit weak points in the siege lines, but all it did was result in massive casualties. Plus, for most of the winter, it was 20 to 30 below zero, so the men lacking proper winter clothes suffered frostbite and other diseases. So the fault of this was not on the men. The Austrian soldiers fought valiantly in a hopeless situation. But imagine fighting from December, January, February, and then at the end of the month receive word from your commander-in-chief, yeah, nothing's coming. No more men, no more supplies. Hold out under all circumstances. But by mid-March, the Russians begin knocking out some of the forts, pulverizing some of the trenches, blasting through the barbed wire, and not really in a symmetrical pattern, but at different points, they begin slowly penetrating the lines, forcing the defensive ring to fall back on itself. In the end, on March 17th, 117,000 Austrian soldiers surrendered, and the Russians would take possession. Now the plan was, because they knew the map, the plan was, now that they're in possession of Przemysl, that this would become the headquarters of a mobile cavalry army, the 8th Army, commanded by Alexei Brusilov, who was going to take possession of Przemysl
and race down into the Hungarian plain with basically the plan to then sweep across, lay siege to Budapest, knock Hungary out, and then continue on to Austria. Because they received intelligence that all of the Austrian soldiers were either on the Galician border or down in Serbia. There was nothing here. All they had to do was go.
The war would be over just like that. The problem is that because of this protracted siege, it was as costly for the victors as it was for the losers. The Austrians lost 86,000 men who were killed in action. 117,000 surrendered, essentially eliminating two entire armies. But the Russians, just during the second siege, suffered 115,000 casualties. When you combine that with the 40 from the first attempt, 150,000 men down. And you have the Germans advancing in the north. So we'll call this a Pyrrhic victory. So yeah, they won the fort, but they can't hold it. And they can't advance. Questions? So all that's playing out in the east. What happens as a reaction? Well, in Berlin, this was a wake-up call for the Kaiser and Falkenhayn. Because they suddenly, they knew the terrain, they knew the situation. They knew with the Russians holding Przemysl, if the Russians actually penetrated, their ally is gone. So, Hindenburg is calling in saying, look, if we can continue our advance through East Prussia, that will force the Russians to withdraw, to hold off. And if we could get some more men to help boost up the Austrians, we can hold the line. So in hearing this, the Kaiser grudgingly agreed to take more men from the west and begin transporting them to the east, thereby making it impossible for a massive breakthrough in France. Hindenburg assured the Kaiser in his reports, I can do this. If you give me enough men, I can simultaneously drive the Russians back and sweep south and seize Warsaw. Warsaw was the major Russian railhead in their western lands. Every major railroad that went east had connections that took you to Warsaw.
So if the Germans could get Warsaw, they could use the Russians' own line and begin sending men in all directions.
And possibly even down into the Ukraine. That would be glorious. Problem is, as the reports were coming in, Falkenhayn became terrified of Hindenburg's ambition. Hindenburg is trying to make him a superstar, which could possibly propel him into being the head of the general staff. taking control of operations of the entire German war machine. And that's something Falkenhayn did not want. So he still believed victory could only occur in the West. So in sending men to Hindenburg, he only gave them enough to cripple the Russians, but not to kill them. And as far as the situation goes, because Falkenhayn was in Berlin, he always had the Kaiser's ear. So in the end, Falkenhayn would win over the Kaiser, and the Kaiser would order some men. Just enough. But not enough to achieve the objective, which pissed Hindenburg off to no end. So what was given to them? Well, Falkenhayn would scrap together another army, the 11th German Army. But the addition of one army wasn't enough to turn the tide. But that's not to say they didn't try. On May 2nd, the Austrian forces, along with the newly created 11th Army, would actually engage the Russian forces north of Przemysl. In 3 days of fighting, they managed to destroy the 3rd Army, inflicting upon Russia 400,000 casualties, resulting in another observation from the British Field Marshal. General Marshal? I forgot what his rank was. I have it abbreviated. I have his name just as Knox. What was his rank? It was in the section where I was talking about how bad Russia was. Major General. Knox. He reported to London that the Russian army, the army is now a harmless mob. All realize the futility of sending men against the enemy. So the moment the Germans started attacking, the Russians basically began surrendering. The Russian soldiers were not necessarily afraid of the Austrians, but they were terrified of the Germans. And if you have an army that's going to surrender 400,000 men, how are you going to win a war? Ultimately, this would result in the surrender of Przemysl. Russia would quickly withdraw, would scrap the plans to knock Austria out, and would, of course, perpetuate the war.
Once Przemysl was abandoned, the Russians would quickly retreat, but the German 11th, supported by the Austrians, pursued. They managed to capture the city of Lviv.
In Lviv, they stumbled upon reserve shells and ammunition that the Russians tried moving forward to take the Przemysl, but didn't necessarily have time to deploy it fully. Now, granted, the rounds were different than what the Germans or the Austrians used, but if you come across a large stockpile of your enemy's munitions, what can you do to it?
Destroy it or use it against them?
You can destroy it. Or, in the case of the artillery, they're capturing a whole bunch of Russian artillery cannon. Oh, we'll put them in your army and you let your enemy, whose rounds that are now yours, can use them to kill them. A week later, the Germans spread out.
And what was supposed to be in an advance, just to kind of move the lines a little bit, actually, to the surprise of everybody, would turn into a complete rout. When the Russians learned that Przemyśl fell and that Lviv fell, and now that they have no artillery and fewer bullets, every single fighting position that the Russians had held at the beginning of 1915, they surrendered and they withdrew. All of the armies pulled back in a chaotic retreat.
You cannot imagine how one-sided this was. Again, I'm just talking. But we're talking the span of 3 or 4 weeks. The Germans and the Austrians were able to push the lines hundreds of miles forward with no resistance. But you take land. All they did was carve out most of Poland. Russia still exists. Russia's capacity to put millions of men on the field still exists. Because in the end, the Germans didn't have enough to actually win. So, everything stops. Questions? All right. I want to go forward, or I want to call it a day. I think I'll call it a day. I got farther than I wanted to. I got faster than I wanted to. Because there were no questions. So I assume you're getting it all. Now, you guys got the book? How far into the book have I gotten? I got to be at least 5 or 6 chapters in, I would think. I haven't read that book in like 15 years.
But hopefully you're just kind of keeping up. So this exam, which you're going to get next week, unlike the first exam, which was mostly the political stuff, obviously we covered lots of battles.
I'm not going to make you remember all the details, all the deaths, and all the rest. But if there's something special that pops up about a battle, that's the kind of things that you want to remember. As far as the leaders go, if a name comes up, that could be a source of questions. Obviously, on the German side, I'm keeping it to a minimum. You know, you got the big 3 or 4. Kaiser, Ludendorff, Falkenhayn, Moltke. We talked about Moltke a little bit, the younger. And, of course, Hindenburg. But on the Russian side, we got a whole bunch of generals. I only mention the generals because it's like a row of dominoes. Every time a field commander arises, they lose and they're removed. So don't necessarily stress out too much with them. I don't think I've given you really any Austrian generals focusing on Conrad. I'm trying to just keep it as simple as possible. But if you can make sense of things, again, we're going to see 1915 was kind of like a pendulum. Started going one way, and then it would come back to exactly where it was in 1914. Well, the East, they would advance. But for the most part, the war is remained static. So if you can just kind of keep track of all that stuff, you will all do well on exam number 2. So, I'm going to, I don't know. I could knock it out. I could have everything done on 2. No, I don't think I don't have enough time to do everything on 2. So, what you're going to do is you're going to get the exam after Thursday's class. But I know it's spring break. I want to do it now rather than have you come back and do it on a Monday. So, what I will do is I will open up the exam and I'll give you like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I'll give you a whole bunch of days at the beginning of break just to get it done. Just so that way, if you do go away, you have a chance to get to wherever you're going, become situated before worrying about the exam. The other thing, and again, I'm just going to throw it out there, and I'm more recording because half the class isn't here, extra credit too. Don't forget, if you're actually reading All Quiet on the Western Front, you want to send me some chapters, don't hesitate to do so. Because extra credit, earning extra credit, is always good at any time of the semester. All right. Any questions for me? All right. Sayonara. See ya.